Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is our third series on the war in Vietnam, and our purpose is getting folks who were vets, I was not a vet, to come and talk about it. And a lot of the situations that have come up, people haven't talked about for a long time. In getting folks to do this, to interview them, I've had some people say they would love to do it. I've had some people come out of the woods and say they've never told anybody about their experiences. And so I'm kind of getting the just a little bit of everybody. But I think one of the things that I think is important is that the folks, the men and the women that fought in Vietnam, you know, not everybody went into that war as a hardened mercenary. The people and the men and the women that went into that war were those folks you graduated with, those average people that lived in my town, Ellensburg, and Gary's town, Graham, and wound up in a different world virtually overnight. And so during this interview, we'd like to talk to Rick Adler. And Rick, tell me where you live now. Is Cleveland or someplace back there?
I live in the suburbs of Cleveland, a place called North Ridgeville.
And does Cleveland have a football? Does Cleveland have a football team? NFL football team?
Well, in my mind, they have no football team because they left.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
but there is an NFL franchise here at this point, and they're getting better.
Well, that's good. That's good. You know, I don't want to disparage anybody because of their football team. We are the Seahawks, and we usually get into the playoffs, and then that's it, you know. But anyhow, let's talk a little bit about, I know that we'll talk later and have you finish the story that was started when we were interviewing Gary. But where did you do your basic training?
I did my basic training at Fort Gordon, Georgia, basic and AIT.
Okay, and then you flew from there to Los Angeles or Seattle, or how did
what happened was when I finished my AIT, I was given a 30-day leave and went back to my hometown of Olmsted Falls, Ohio, and then on to Vietnam. I went through Fort Lewis to Hawaii, to Cameron Bay, and landed in Vietnam.
Okay. And one thing I forgot to say, and I need to say this, so I'm going to interject it right now. Both Gary Burka and you, Rick Adler, received Silver Star Award for heroism, and I think that's heroism in battle, and at Fort Lewis a year or 2 years ago. And I think that's just really a tribute to you as individuals. So tell me your first impression of landing there in Vietnam. Is it very similar to Gary's and everybody else?
Well, when you land there in the heat and the humidity and the stink of that place hits you, your first thought is, where the hell am I and what am I doing here? Because you had no idea that that's what it was going to be like. I mean, you had no idea of what it was going to be like or how it was going to take place or anything.
Yeah, so it wasn't like, like we're in Disneyland. It's, you know, very different from that, I suppose. So
very different.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I know back in Cleveland, it gets pretty hot and humid in the summer, in Chicago and those places too, but nothing to compare to it. And so then
you,
once
you can't compare it to anything that I've ever been through in my entire life, the heat and the humidity over there.
And then when you got over there, did they, you know, immediately kind of send you out to a station? Were you with Gary for in the
well,
same t-
well, what happened was when I got at Chiron Bay, then I went up to 2 Live, and from there I went out to Delta in that. But when I was at 2 Live, I basically was going to jungle classes and different things and learning more that they never taught us in AIT because, you know, now all of a sudden this is what you're going to face in this area. We were up in I Corps, which is the northernmost part of Vietnam. So they probably kind of geared the training and the classes to what you were about to see out there or experience out there, I would think, as opposed to being down in the paddies down by Saigon and places like that.
And I would imagine, too, I don't want to beat this horse, but it also sounds like, you know, you could do training with weapons, with rucksacks, go on a 12-mile hike like Gary did, and nothing again to compare it to in this type of environment with carrying all that stuff around in that heat and humidity.
Your rucks probably weighed anywhere from 80 to 90 pounds, maybe a little bit more, because what you carried is what you had. There was no place to get something. And we were out there for sometimes weeks at a time, you know, and hopefully get resupplied now and then, which was tough sometimes being in triple canopy jungles. But you carried anything and everything that you possibly could. And you also carried things for other people. You know, you carried rounds for the machine gun. You might have been carrying a mortar that day for the mortar platoon, different things like that. Not only your personal stuff, I carried a usually around 6 bandoliers of magazines for my M16.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. So let's go back to this, and you can do a little recall, but, you know, we were talking about the time that you and Gary were in a firefight, and it was kind of a horseshoe ambush. And so let's go back to that after things started happening there.
Well, basically what happened was, you know, you were fighting for your life because they being the NVA, were there to eliminate every one of us. They wanted us out of there. And that's why they did the horseshoe ambush, because you have to try and picture that. To be able to do that, you have to cover a huge amount of ground to get these guys in there, you know, as a company. Because we're not walking in a single file or anything like that. Close together, we're spread out. And during the firefight, everybody's doing their own thing, basically, meaning trying to keep the guy on the right and the guy on the left alive, not along with yourself. And after I was hit the first time, you know, you just keep going. And then a while later, I got hit a second time moving around. And I'm thinking, well, shit, this isn't getting any better now. And then when I was hit the third time, I just figured that's it. I'm going to die over here. And Gary was probably, I don't know how far away from me he was, maybe 30, 50, 40 rounds, whatever, yards. And he could see that they were walking in mortars on me. And what I mean by that is, a mortar would hit, then they'd adjust it to try to get in so they could hit the bullseye, being me. And Gary rushed forward and pulled me out of there because I couldn't move at that point and saved my life. And he was hit while doing that. And after he probably had me maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 yards away from where I was last at, a mortar hit and right exactly where I was at. And had it not been for Gary Burka, I'd be dead today. He saved my life.
Well, I'm glad for both of you, very much so. And, I think the also thing that it makes me realize is that, I guess over there, life is really measured in inches. I mean,
It absolutely is, Stephen, because when you first get over there, at least for me, it's like, oh, I'll never get hit with this little round, and I'll be okay, and I'll do this, and I'll do that. Well, once you get hit, you realize, holy cow, how easy it is to get hit. And like I said, it's the one time in your life you're literally fighting for your life, but you're willing to give up your life and risk whatever happens to you to save your buddy's life.
And I think it's interesting that in a situation like that, if you had time to think about it logically and say, you know, do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? And if that had been how Gary had reacted, you probably wouldn't have made it. But you do things automatically. You do, you know, it's that adrenaline.
Correct.
It's everything like that. Yeah.
Correct, because you don't think, number one, when you are in a firefight. You just react. Because if you do think, you're probably going to die.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's all reactions, what you were taught, how you react, what you do at that moment. Because, I mean, you got rounds. They're hitting inches from you. You can hear them hitting the ground and going over your head. And it's just, it's something that nobody should ever have to witness or be a part of.
Yeah.
But because of the way the world is, it happens.
I've never, you know, obviously, you know, not being a vet, I've never experienced that. But my friends that are have said to me that the most terrifying noise they ever heard was, you know, hearing the sound of a bullet go by them. And like one of my friends said, it's the most terrifying and it's the most relieving at the same time, because you know if you hear it go by you, it went by you. And that's
they say you never hear the one that gets you.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And so then you were medevaced, I'm assuming. Were they able to bring in helicopters?
I was dusted off. From there I went to Duck Fall, to Chulai, to Cameron Bay, and then to Japan. And I was out of Vietnam for 60 days in hospitals due to combat wounds. And then I came back and finished my tour with Delta. And, you know, it's funny, Stephen. My mom passed away a few years ago, and she saved every letter I ever wrote to her. And in these letters that I'm writing and I'm reading, and the one letter, well, not one, just many of them, as I'm in the hospital, I go, well, Mom, maybe I'll come back to the world. And then in the next sentence, I'm going, but, Mom, I don't want to come back to the world because I want to go back and be with the guys out in the bush, because you don't want to leave them no matter what. And that's sometimes why a lot of veterans have guilt, because
they didn't go back?
Be there.
Or they didn't go back.
They didn't go, some of them didn't go back. In fact, I got a great. I had a friend who I went through basic AIT with from the Pittsburgh area that I met. That he got hit in that firefight also that Gary and I were injured in, and he went to Panama after that, and he had guilt with him for his entire life because he was never able to come back out to the bush and be with us and be there while we're in firefights and help and contribute. Because when you went out to the bush, you know, you didn't go back out there as a platoon or a company or anything like that. You went out, you know, individually. And if four guys went out, okay, well, this one goes to first platoon, this one goes to second, that one goes to third, that one goes to fourth platoon. And you didn't really know those people when you went out there. In today's world, they go over as companies. They go over together, and
like a cohort kind of a group that trains together. Yeah.
With us, it was kind of like a revolving door. Okay, this guy's getting out of the bush. Here comes his new replacement, which was often referred to as an FNG, but I won't tell you what that stands for. Most
okay.
people can.
Yeah, and please don't.
Pretty I won't. But, you know, it's, and then you have a love for those that you serve with that people can't understand, meaning that I will do anything for any one of those jungle warriors that I served with. If they were to call today, I'd be there tomorrow for them. And the perfect example is Gary called me up one night and says, "Hey, I need you to do me a favor." And I said, "What is it? I'll do it." It's a love, a brotherhood, as so many people put it, that people just don't understand. I mean, the funny thing was when I got out and Gary got out, I tried to find Gary. I didn't know how to spell his name. He tried to find me. He didn't know how to spell my last name. We had nicknames. We never had anything on our uniforms because of the where we were at, and you didn't need it. You weren't back in the rear. Nobody needed to know your name. So,
is Gary's nickname something you can say? On
Gary's nickname and my nicknames probably are best to always be
okay.
not divulged.
I would call Gary Smiley because he's over here, you know. Mm-hmm. He's got the nicest smile on his face.
Mm-hmm.
I would think
absolutely does.
You know, so that's so yeah, I think that when you mentioned, you know, you would, like, there were four of you and you would go out, you'd go to different units. When you went to that unit and you were the one guy that went in there, were people supportive of you? Were they apprehensive of you? How did that work?
They really didn't associate with you. They didn't really want anything to do to you with you. And that's because, you know what, you got to prove yourself before we get close to you, because sometimes it was the fairly new guys that got hit. And it's one of those things where, okay, you proved yourself, you've earned it, and now you're part of us. So when new guys would get to a company and then a platoon and a squad and that, people really just kind of didn't warm up to them right away. It's kind of like, prove yourself.
Yeah, I know that's my friend Alan Aronica, who we're going to be interviewing here in a few weeks. He said that was kind of his experience. That when he first went to a new unit, people were pleasant to him, didn't really avoid him, but didn't go out of their way to, you know, be friends. They were
correct.
more observers, and like he said, they wanted to know if there was a tough situation out there, if I was going to be the person that was going to back them up. And you know, that's the thing, is I think you're, you know, very few.
Could you count on them? Yeah, kind of.
Right.
Like, can I count on you to be there when I need you?
Yeah,
that type of thing.
And I think very, very, very few of us in the world today, or in the United States today, you know, we may have medical situations, we may have other things, but there are very few of us that virtually have a situation where if we make the wrong move, you know, it's going to make the difference between life and death. And,
correct.
I know, Gary's talked about one of the officers that he was with, that he saw a bouncing Betty, which is basically, you know what it is, if it's a booby trap,
yep.
but basically for everybody else, and maybe we'll let Gary finish this, but as I understand what they are, is it's a booby trap, and it has the you step on it, and the explosive comes up about waist length and then explodes. So it
correct.
Has the most explosive power. And Yeah. And I'm going to, if you don't mind, do you mind, Rick, if I bring Gary in to talk about that just a bit?
Bring him in.
All right. And here comes Smiley. See, that's my, yeah, okay, that's my new nickname for him. Okay. Gary, yeah. Go ahead.
We had I became an RTO after I healed up. And from the ambush, I came back out into the field.
And an RTO is?
A radio telephone operator.
Okay.
And so I became an RTO walking behind the lieutenant. And all of, you know, one day we're walking down the trail, and the next thing I realize, I look down where the lieutenant's feet are, and I realize I'm seeing three little pointies sticking up, and I you know, recognize it to be a Bouncing Betty, and I yell at the top of my lungs, you know, freeze, and everybody just freezes right there, and lieutenant got his foot down on it, but not with a lot of weight, and about this time, all of a sudden, I get a call from a chopper coming in, telling of my a roster number that he's got a new job placement, and then I realize this roster number is mine, you know, and I'm excited. I'm thinking, wow, I don't have to spend the night on the ground anymore. I can be on a bed. I can get hot meals. I can, you know, I can be out of the field where you're fairly safe, and you know, everything's going through my mind, and I drop the radio down, you know, set the radio down, and here comes the chopper within, you know, vision. I can see the chopper coming, and then they land, and I go over, and they said, get aboard. You know, they asked me who I was and stuff. I get aboard and take off. I get up in the chopper, and then I look down, and I realize, gee, I just left the lieutenant over a Bouncing Betty.
Oh, jeez. Oh, wow.
And I yell at the captain flying the chopper. I says, hey, sir, I've got to go back. I've got to go back. I've lost my head here, you know. I got to get back. He says, hey, we're short on time. I can't take you back. Well,
it's almost as critical as someone saying, where's my cell phone?
Yeah. You know? Well, some 40 years later, we had a reunion down in Arizona, and I met this lieutenant, and he survived, and everything was fine. We laughed about it, but it was quite the experience for both.
Yes, yes. Rick, you know, one of the things I'd like you to talk about, I know we're kind of, we've got a few more minutes left and stuff, but, you know, one of the things that when we talk about this war lasting so long are things like, you know, PTSD that, you know, really after World War II, people just didn't talk. We really didn't, you know, we know about it now, but we really didn't know about it then. But I think one of the most devastating things that I've seen come out of Vietnam is Agent Orange, and I know Chris has experienced some of that with Parkinson's. I think Gary, you've had some issues with Agent Orange.
Yes.
And I know Rick, you mentioned that you've had some issues too. Can you talk about the Agent Orange a little bit and kind of explain to people what it was and how it was used?
What it was is it's basically like Roundup. It kills everything instantly. And, you know, I've had stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I've had stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I've had a stem cell transplant. And you always have to, I've always believed and have faith in different things like that. But, you know, I'm going to die with cancer, but I'm not going to die because of it. I'm not going to let Vietnam be the reason that I do die. And you know what? That's something that's always bothered me, not only that pertains to us Vietnam veterans, but those that have come back from Iraq, Afghanistan, and all those other countries. And it's the issues of the long-term effects of things. It's Agent Orange, burn pits, all those types of things that we had to experience. You know, there's over 58,000 names on the Vietnam Wall that died from a direct result of the war. We never hear about the tens of thousands of names of the veterans that have passed since the end of those wars. And they died from the things that happened during that war, the various cancers and the other diseases that were a direct result of Agent Orange. People, they forget about the families who lost their loved ones, our friends and that, and the pain, the suffering they had to go through. Veterans endure many hardships when they come back. I mean, what, we've got 20 veterans a day committing suicide? And it's basically because they can't live with the past and deal with the future. The things that they've seen, things that no person should ever witness or be a part of. It's not only PTSD, it's depression, it's alcohol, drug abuse, suicides, financial hardships that they go through, our families go through. Nobody goes into the military because of what they get paid.
Yeah, and
they
go in
for one reason, and that's love. Yeah. Love of their country, love of freedom, and what they want their loved ones to enjoy.
Yeah.
And we need people to find a way somehow to maybe reach us. I mean, it's one thing for me to call Gary when I'm going through something and Gary call me or whatever. But it's hard to see your body change and not be what it once was, whether it be the loss of limbs, the burns. I mean, burns, God, most people can't even look at them. In fact, they turn away when they see somebody coming down the street. And sometimes, as we've gotten older, and it's been over 50 years, we really wonder, well, what was it about? And did anyone really ever care? And those are the things that are tough to deal with.
And I think that you really, the point that you make that I really, the one that sticks with me the most is, you know, you mentioned the 58,000, and I hate to even say that because I know it's more than 58,000. I'm not excluding anybody. But, you know, when you think about the average age of the person, of the soldiers in Vietnam was 23.
Yep.
About 20,000 of them were married. I can't remember, probably a half of that had kids. And, you know, you're also, if you're 20, 21, 22, you also have aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and everything else. And so I just think we need to look at that entire scope. And I think even, and I'm not, you know, just that I talked to my, we talk about Agent Orange, even my friend who now lives in Vietnam. I have a friend that lives in Ho Chi Minh City. Interviewed him, and you know, people in Vietnam are still dealing with Agent Orange themselves.
And
you know,
booby traps.
And booby traps, especially, I think he said in the along the Cambodian body or the Cambodian border, there's still a tremendous amount of ordnance that they're still trying to get up. And
right.
So, you know, we may even try and do this again. This has just been, you guys have made my day for what you've done for this country. And, I just,
Stephen, could I say one thing?
You're the easiest interviewer in the world, Rick, because, you know, some guys just say yes, no, you explain it well. So, And you can also come back. We've still got one more interview to do with Chris. And you can also come back and make a comment there. I'll make sure we've got time for you there, too.
Okay. But, so I just hang on the line?
Yeah, you just hang on the line. And we'll do the same thing. I'll kind of do some introduction with Chris and talk to him about a few different things. And Smiley's just going to sit over there and, give Chris a bad time, make faces at him and stuff. And so thank you very much. Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate your emails, and I hope I get to meet you someday. And we'll talk to you again soon. So thank you, Vashon. Thank you, Vashon. We will talk to you on the next series.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you, Rick.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.
All right. Now, if anybody needs a restroom, we can just stop for a minute. There's a restroom right over there. Okay, good.
There for and, a while, I tried to ask a question. I couldn't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And you did a good job. We only had to cut out two words, I think. And that was good. Yeah. Well, yeah. We were able to pull Gaynor out of the ceiling and, unfortunately, and so he's going to be talking now. The one thing I would say is when you talk, if you can, you know, don't hit the desk a lot because it'll pop off. And I'm not trying to be a pain in the ass or anything else. Can we say pain in the ass? We can't say
pain in the ass.
We can't. I could say Gaynor is a pain in the ass, and okay, and that would be okay. All right, but I won't do that. So let's get ready, and we can go ahead and do our intro.
We'll do it. Here we go.
Welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, and this is a series we're doing on Vietnam. We are looking not at Vietnam from a political standpoint necessarily, or not what we can do today to make things different. But it really was my purpose in doing this to talk to the people that were there, to try and understand. And you can never, people say they can walk a mile in your shoes and this and that. You can't walk an inch in anybody else's shoes. Everybody has their own unique situation, whether it's you or me or whoever. And, so that's our purpose, is to get the voices heard of the people that participated in the war and hear what they have to say. And during this interview, we're going to be interviewing Christopher Gaynor. Chris is a vet, and we'll ask him some questions about that. He was in Vietnam. But Chris has also written a book. And Chris, tell me, what's the name of your, I should know the name of your book.
It's called A Soldier Boy Hears the Distant Guns.
A Soldier Boy Hears the Sound of the Distant Guns. And is that on Amazon? Can people buy that on Amazon?
No, it's Blurb.
Okay.
Now, I don't sell it on Amazon because it's too expensive. Nobody will buy it.
Okay.
I give it away, I buy it and give it away.
Okay. And maybe we can... And if anybody would like to get a copy of that book or buy a copy of that book, You
blurb.com.
can contact me at Voice of Vashon, and I'll only be taking probably 10-20% cut of that. So not really, but
don't you
anyhow, wait. Yes. So Chris has also been very vocal in working on the island with vets. There's actually a pretty active organization going on Vashon Island. And for 13 years, well, he has been actively involved for the last 13 years in really pushing the rights of vets, working with vets who have had the same kind of problems that he's had and others have had with Agent Orange. And when I decided to do this series, he was the first one that contacted me. And he and I have worked very closely in getting the names of the other people, like Rick. We interviewed him in one of our previous programs, and Gary Burka. And Chris, is there anything else I should say about you that would make you walk on water even more, or...
Well, nobody wanted it, so I became commander of the American Legion on the island.
Okay, so you're commander of the American...
I was, not anymore.
You were, okay.
And I was an officer in the VFW on Vashon for many years, very close to all the VFW and American Legion guys. And we are now the center of the Vashon Veterans Retreat Center, which is on the island, and it's open to any veteran. We have all kinds of facilities there. We can connect them up with therapists and people who will help them fill out paperwork for benefits. And we have
And Mike Mattingly works down
there. Yes, Mike Mattingly is now our commander-in-chief, I call him, because he's the commander of the VFW and the American Legion, and he is president of the association that runs the...
I wonder if they wouldn't at that retreat center, they wouldn't have Gary Burker's memorial bottle of 151 proof rum that he brought back with him.
You know, that's a great artifact. I think we need to have it gold plated.
I think we should. I think you know we used to bronze shoes and stuff. We could bottle bronze his bottle of 151 proof rum. That sounds good.
If you go in there and you walk back, you'll see all my pictures on the walls.
Great, yeah.
I just took them and pinned them up because we're not ready.
And also, Christopher and I have been talking about another project. I always thought it would be really nice. I saw a program at the Museum of Modern Art in New York after the 9/11 attack, and they just had photographs, just individual photographs of people and pictures that people had taken at that day. And I've been back to the wall in DC several times, and it's the most stunning thing I've ever seen. It's so plain and yet so meaningful, I think, is what strikes me about it. But I would thought it would always be nice just to have a wall of pictures, you know, just of people and family, and so that we know just how many folks that really does involve.
Put a face to it.
Yeah, I think that's what we need to do. You know, that's so true, Chris. Put a face to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think somebody is now compiling something of people that have been, killed by COVID. Mm-hmm. And what does it do for us now? Like I said, every night on the news, we saw Walter Cronkite, 3,000 Vietnamese killed, mm-hmm. 200 American troops killed. We don't think about the, you think about a number, you don't think about the families. And, we were the American side, we went over there, but I think you also have to realize that they're, everybody else was doing their job, and there are other families that are grieving over there, I think that's important. So tell us a little bit, tell about your experience. Where were you living and when you went to Vietnam, and were you drafted, or how did that all go about?
Well, my story is a little different. I met a few guys that were from my background. I grew up in what I would call extreme privilege. My father was vice president of Don Lee Mutual Broadcasting and general sales manager of the biggest radio network in the world. And we moved to Encino, which was near L.A., and we had an acre of property, so I could go and run around out there, and that was fun. But we had beach houses at Newport Beach, Balboa Island. And so in 1954, we moved to Balboa Island, and our neighbors were John Wayne and Gene Kelly and people like that.
John Wayne was a Green Beret, I think, wasn't he?
Well, he played one.
Yes.
And I want to hear more from him about that if he ever resurrected.
Came back to life, yes, yeah. That's right.
Well, you know, my background was in Newport Harbor High School, and, you know, I thought everybody was rich and played and surfed and sat at the beach all day, and wasn't so true. But I was going to college, and I had a college deferment, and I felt at one point I was looking at my colleagues and my comrades from high school who were going to Vietnam and getting killed. I thought, this is crazy. I'm sitting here with my friends, you know, smoking dope and you know, not doing anything. And so I put myself up to the draft board and said, take me now. And they did. In about 2 weeks, I got my induction notice. I reported to the induction center in Los Angeles. We picked 6:30 in the morning, picked us up in a bus, took us up there, and we stepped forward and swore allegiance to the United States, and we were in the Army. We're in the military. And some of us went into the...
Do they really go in there and do that thing where they give you all a haircut?
Yes. First thing that happened...
As short as it is now?
Yeah. Shorter. Oh, okay. No, it was like not a hair longer right. than a millimeter.
Okay.
And, you know, made everybody look the same. And they took all our clothes and put us in a uniform with a shaved head, and everybody looks the same. You know, you can't. Nobody knew that I came from a privileged, you know, background with a family that had a beachfront home. And, you know, I sailed and swam all summer with my friends from high school. And suddenly, I'm with all these other guys, and it was a great learning experience for me. It was wonderful. I met lots of great people. And for the first time in my life, I really took a serious look at other parts of the country and my friends that came from there. So that was my background. And when I stepped forward, I said, okay, I'm going to go find out what this is all about. I want to find out what this war is about. I'm going to get right in the middle of it. So I volunteered, and they took me. I went to Fort Riley, Kansas. We trained as a division, 9th Infantry Division. They reinstated the division, reactivated it, and there were, I can't remember how many thousands of us were on Fort Riley, Kansas. Basically, we went through basic training together, AIT, and then we got on a ship. My ship was the USS Geiger, which was a troop ship from the 50s. And we went from 3 weeks across the ocean to Vung Tau, Vietnam. And we were just, you know, it gave us a little acclimatization, acclimatized. You know, it took us a little bit longer than taking a jet plane. And 3 weeks, and, you know, there were thousands of us in the hold, and we were 4 bunks stacked high. And so you could barely squeeze into your bunk. And fortunately, I wasn't ever seasick because I was a sailor. All my buddies were seasick and they couldn't eat. It was awful for them. But we got to Vung Tau. They took us in landing craft. We were all suited up with our ammo and ready to go, you know, get the enemy. We hit the beach and the candy striper girls were there singing. And, you know, it was like, this is war. You know, young women, you know, who were there just to greet us. So we went and got into deuce and a half trucks, and we convoyed from Vung Tau to Camp Cox, which was Bear Cat. A lot of people know that it's Bear Cat. They had taken and sprayed that with full-strength Agent Orange, which is full of dioxin. It killed everything, and I took pictures of it. It looks like a desert, and it was triple canopy jungle.
And I've seen, you know, I've seen many of those pictures where, you know, guys are out humping in the field, and you just go by these trees that are just, they're just, you know, there's no, well, there's limbs on them, but I mean, everything is virtually bare. I mean, you look and there's 30, 40 trees out there, and you can just see right through them.
They scraped it. They poisoned it, and then they scraped it, and they put us in there, and we ate that stuff. We breathed it. It was in our food. We slept in it. And, you know, that's why I have Parkinson. And a lot of my friends are dead from Agent Orange-related illnesses. Like Rick said, he had all these cancers, and Gary had problems. You know, I just want to say one thing about Gary and Rick. The Silver Star is the third highest award that the United States government gives for extraordinary bravery and heroism. That's a big deal. The first one is the Medal of Honor. Second one is the Distinguished Service Cross, and then the Silver Star. Very few. They're the only two guys I know that got a Silver Star, except for on the island, Donald Holkey had a Silver Star. And he's one of the 12 guys that was killed in Vietnam from Vashon.
And there are 12 guys from Vashon, as small as Vashon is. 12 guys from Vashon that have been killed in Vietnam.
Yeah, it was 5,500 population and 12 deaths. That's somehow, you know, actuarially able to tell you that's not possible, but it was. And, you know.
I think in Ellensburg, when I, there were people out of my graduating class that died as a result of Agent Orange and, you know, and resulting kinds of things. But there was only one, it wasn't in my class, but one person from Ellensburg that I think that was killed later. Mm-hmm. And there's a memorial out there at the cemetery for him. Okay. So you hit there, and did you immediately get signed to something out in the bush? And
well, we were still under construction at Camp Martin Cox Bearcat, so they put us to work, and it was hot. I'm sorry, it was hot, and it was sweaty, and it was awful. You know,
not like a California beach then.
No, it was February.
Okay,
and it was so hot. I thought my brain was going to explode inside my head. But they could put us to work, and then fortunately for me, I complained to my CEO. I wanted to be somewhere where I could see a little more action. So they infused me to the 77th Field Artillery in Dao Tieng, which was the Michelin rubber plantation, still operating. And the Michelin rubber plantation manager had a deal with the Viet Cong and had a deal with us. You break a tree, you blow up a tree, you pay me $300. And we paid a lot of $300, I'll tell you.
It sounds like when you went out there to, to make a really bad joke, that was apparently for you where the rubber really hit the road.
Yes, we were definitely. It was a beautiful, beautiful base because all the colonial French architecture was still there. And so we used it. And I've got pictures of it. It looks like a resort. And a lot of my buddies were resentful because they thought we had it really good. But I only spent 10% or 15% of my time on base. We were jumping into Hueys and being dropped into remote fire support bases on the Cambodian border and just getting the...
So were you dropped in there as support of the fire base?
Yes.
Or?
I was... My job was to coordinate with the strategic command of the 25th Infantry Division for intel that came to us. For example, we see a suspicious craft, watercraft, going down the river, and we know that they're carrying ammunition. So we call a fire mission in on it, drop a 105 millimeter howitzer around right in the middle of their boat, and boom, they're gone. And I was the one who sent those orders up. And, you know, I have all that guilt to live with. But
How did you know that they were carrying ammunition?
Well, the intel would come to us, and that would be the information that we really wanted. If it was just somebody fishing, we didn't want to blow them up.
Right.
So, the other thing was, and I'm very careful about this, but we had secret clearances, and we had a type of warhead that I won't mention what it is, but it was tactical. And we never used it, thank God, because if we had, it would have been World War III. So use your imagination and put those pieces together. Mm-hmm. we could send an encrypted message every day we changed our encryption, and we sent it radio teletype, long range, and that would be, if the balloon went up and we got orders for those kind of warheads, we were the ones who did the missions.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend that was on some kind of a boat on the river all the time, and that's what they did was they went up and down the river, and they would a lot of times, you know, here'd be a little sandpan or a little boat, and it's, you know, got mom and pop and a kid in it fishing, and the whole thing, you know, they go in and check it out, and the whole thing is loaded with, you know, with weaponry and stuff like that. And that's, you know, I would have to say, you know, the one thing that I read, you know, about Vietnam was that the North Vietnamese were very clever about how they moved supplies around, you know, with individuals and, you know, a line of 100 people, each one carrying a couple mortars or something.
Well, that was the Ho Chi Minh Trail. When I was there, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was footpath, and you could get vehicles through there, but they didn't. We bombed it constantly. But the Ho Chi Minh Trail emptied right into our lap. I was in three-core war zone C, which went from Saigon east all the way west to the Cambodian border. And we were working on top of the Revolutionary Provisional Government bunkers, which were under us. They were huge. They had hospitals. They had administrators. They had electricity. And we tried to bomb them. There's no bomb big enough to get those bunkers. They're so deep. And you know, I learned more about this after.
How deep are you're talking about the, or they just had the tunnels and all
that
stuff?
Yeah, tunnels, yeah. But this was, what we were working on was called the Revolutionary Provisional Government, which was the shadow government that would take over when the Republic of Vietnam went under. And they were ready they had, you know, ministers of every department that they needed. Wow. And they could have walked right in and taken over.
And these were all pretty much hand dug, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, it was all hand dug. And little buckets, and they would disperse it so you wouldn't see it. It was just amazing. We went to Vietnam, back to Vietnam in 2013. We went to the Cu Chi tunnels, and I went down in there and took a look, and I said, I'm not going in there. That's too, you know, they made them bigger for American tourists, but they were tiny, and they used to crawl through there. So we would have, if we were seeing a tunnel and we wanted to find out what was going on, we sent our smallest guy down there with a 45 and a knife, a bayonet or something, and we'd go down there and no light, and if he met somebody, he'd blow them away. And it's not something you really want to experience.
I had a friend who was a tunnel rat.
Yeah.
Very little guy.
Yeah.
And
I was too big, thank God.
Yeah, and that's I can't imagine, I'm claustrophobic anyhow. Oh, yeah. I can't imagine anything much worse than, and of course, I'm sure they were booby trapped. And
Oh, absolutely. Terrible. And so, you know, I was ready for this. I was anxious to do my part, and I wanted to document it. So I had my camera, and I worked the camera and got out some really good pictures, which are in this book here. And we did an exhibit here on the island of my pictures and letters. And I think that it helped me after I got out. I put all this stuff in a box, a Lavoris mouthwash and box, and sealed it up. Carried around with me for 40 years. And one of our Eagle Scouts knew that I had these pictures. And he came to me and said, he was 16 years old. He said, I want to take your pictures and scan them. I said, okay, go. Well, he walked away with my box of pictures. I'll never see them again. But he came back about 9 months later. He had scanned them all and made a slideshow and printed. And it just started me on my path. And this is the result of that. This book and my show at the Heritage Museum got me moving.
Yeah, that's just amazing. And when you came, you know, I know when you came back, and I've heard some of your stuff when you came back to the United States, that you were in Europe for a while, and then you eventually came back to the United States. How were you treated in the United States when you came back, or did people didn't even know you were in Vietnam?
Yeah, the problem was I came back, and they ignored me or they abused me. And so I got both sides. My family was fine. My father was very proud of me. My mother was freaked out. My sister and brother ran, he didn't want anything to do with me. And my friends, who were all liberal, you know, I had developed a network of friends who were liberal lefties. And, you know, I was a member of Congress of Racial Equality. And we were running around doing all kinds of marches and anti-war stuff before I went in the Army. Now, figure that out. I was doing anti-war marches. I was talking about the bad, you know, this war that was going to drag us all down. And yet I was there fighting it. And so when I got back, I tried to talk about it, but nobody wanted to listen. And so I packed up in late 1968, and I took off. I didn't come back till 1975, 7 years. I went to Spain. I went to London, then I went to Spain. I was studying music. I was a guitar player. I studied with a very wonderful classical guitarist in Alicante, Spain. And then I met a friend down there who was also a guitarist. And his name was Edward Flower, and he was the scion of the Flower Brewery fortune. And his mother, Lady Hersey Flower, invited me to go to England. I went there, and I lived there for 7 years.
Wow.
And I came back to the United States in 75, went to school on my GI Bill, and, you know, met my husband, Paul, and started thinking about, you know, what I want to do in my life. I was a musician. I had a teaching job. But it wasn't until Tanner Means, who was the young Eagle Scout who took the pictures and scanned them, that I really thought I had something. And I had several people look at my pictures, like Larry Engelman, who was a scholar. He's passed away now. He was my mentor. He said they were the real deal. And he said, I had a great story. I should tell it. He loved my pictures. He took them everywhere. Sorry.
You know, I think that, I think that's interesting. You mentioned people that did come back and you know, and had anti-war feelings, but they weren't from, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. They were from some, you know, they were all over, but there were some people that, you know, had experienced it, and like you. I'd have to say my, you know, when I was in college, my political feelings generally probably went with more who was the girl I was dating at that time, sure. You know.
That's understandable.
You know, and let me ask, Rick, do you mind if I bring you in here now? And because I know, and again, you know, you and I talked, and we're not going to get political about that, but how did you feel about that? I mean, it must have really felt, even though you didn't understand some of the things, it must have felt really awful to come back as a vet and to have put your life on the line. And in your case, and in Gary's case, you were injured, seriously injured. And then to come back and people were negative towards that. I mean, was that just, and how did you feel about that? That must have been so horrible.
I hated them.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that. I can understand that.
You know, I really don't want to get political or go,
sure,
go down those roads in that.
Right. I promise you. Go ahead.
But yeah. I guess my question would be is, you didn't want us there. You wanted us out of there, but yet you're protesting us and spitting on us and calling us every name under the sun. And, like I said, I pray every day that I don't see somebody burn the American flag or protest, because I will react to them and it will not be in a very good way.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think that I shouldn't get political myself either. I'm going to avoid that too. These are not necessarily the opinions of Voice of Asia, and I think we're supposed to say that occasionally anyhow. But, I think that, again, I think it kind of goes back to, and wouldn't you say that this, Chris, is it goes back to is what, until you were there, you really, and until Gary was there, coming from Graham and you, you know, coming from the beaches of California, you had no clue. And let me ask Gary this. I mean, is that fair to say? You had really, you know, you'd seen it. You'd been to, you know, movies and stuff, but you really had no clue of what war was really like.
No, I didn't. Like I say, the third night that I was in the field on that Snaky, it really brought to life the reality of what I'm about to face. And that was just the beginning.
Was there something special about that third night, or was that?
Well, that's where I was out on the Snaky, and the monkey got killed, and the Chippewa and stuff. And I, you know, I was a young kid, hadn't really seen death and to speak of, and all of a sudden it's right there in front of you, and you could have been involved in it yourself. We could have gotten easily hit by our own guys that night when the company lit up.
And that, I'm sure that happens. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of a misnomer, isn't it? Kind of, you know, we talk about friendly fire. It's really, when it gets you, it's not that friendly, you know.
Right. Over there, you're open to about anything at this point. And but it was a real reality check to me at that point. I really realized how important my family was and everything. And the one good thing I guess I could say is that out of that I was tremendously homesick, and when that kind of thing came about, it wasn't, you weren't homesick, you were reacting and responding.
And I think and I know we've just got a few minutes left, but I wanted to close up with something that I've heard from all these all the folks that I've interviewed, is that, you know, not to take a day for granted, to consider in, I'm not saying this from a religious standpoint, but every day you're alive is a blessing, and every day that you get to interact with people is a blessing. And I think also when the rubber hits the road, or whatever we want to say, you know, we learn what our priorities are, and priorities are family, priorities are loved ones, kids, you know. Even one thing my father always, I'm going to close up this way, but one thing my father always said, and that I will never, ever forget, and he said to, and he did this, he lived this, respect everyone you meet. Treat everyone equally, treat them fairly, and go forward in that way. And if you do, you're going to live a good life. And so thank you, thank you, thank you, everyone today, for talking and speaking. And remember those books. And we will be back next week with more on our series on Vietnam. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Vashon.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofvashon.org and look under the Shows tab.